Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I am celebrating today one of the wonderful things about our art museum here is that they bring to us amazing musicians. And I read about the Verona Quartet. They are coming on March 21st. At 7:30 in the evening to the Mary Craig Auditorium at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. Tickets are extremely reasonable. If you're a member, it's $20. If you're non-member, it's $25. And these are a quartet, a bunch of four musicians that are just so accomplished and so interesting. Their newest album, Shatter, reached number one on the Billboard Classical charts this summer. And they're bringing a really interesting program to Santa Barbara. They're bringing things that you wouldn't necessarily expect. It's outside the usual canon of chamber music. You wouldn't expect the kind of things they're bringing, but they are also bringing some classical chamber music as well. And I want to introduce two of the members to the show today, talk to us a little bit. They're actually joining us from Oberlin, where they teach. And I have Jonathan Dorman, who's a cellist. He is from Yorkshire. And the funny thing about, and a beautiful thing about this quartet is each one of the four are from really different places in the world. Jonathan, as mentioned, from Yorkshire. And I read last night that Jonathan performed at my home festival, which is the Ravinia Festival, used to go with brought up it outside of Northbrook, Illinois, and I used to go to Ravinia almost every performance that I could. It's a beautiful open air park. Jonathan played there. Also, he's been to California playing with USC Wind Ensemble and Symphony and the Manchester International Festival, which is also 6 degrees of separation. I lived in Manchester. I worked for the Manchester Art Museum for a number of years in the Decorative Arts Department. He also studied at USC, and we're going to hear a little bit from Jonathan, and you see Jonathan Dorman. Jonathan Ong is here. There's two Jonathans, so don't be confused. It's Jonathan Ong, Singaporean violinist and the founding member of Verona Quartet. He's been awarded top prizes at many international competitions across four continents, and he has been to Santa Barbara extensively. He was concert master at our own Music Academy of the West. He's also participated in the Aspen Music Festival and IU Festival. And those of us who saw Renee Fleming will be impressed. Renee was just here, by the way. And we will be impressed that Jonathan was often a collaborator for her. He plays a 60. Richard, can you believe this? A 1686 Joseph Guarnerius violin. And I was just about to ask him before we went on the air when he's flying in. He's flying in tomorrow. And I just, you know, I have to know what happens to that violin when he travels with it. He has a bow also, which is a notable bow from an anonymous donor. It's very interesting. So these bows can be worth quite a bit. It's an interesting thing about these the instruments that these guys play. And I want to thank you both for coming on, both Jonathans. Thank you for coming on today, talking to us a little bit about what you do. And first of all, Jonathan Ong, the question at hand, does the violin travel on your lap or you don't check it, do you?
No, I have to bring it on board with me and I put it in the overhead. It's always a little bit of a source of stress, but I feel like the whole quartet, you know, we bring two violins and a viola on board, and Jonathan Dorman has to buy a seat for his cello. So we have a whole system where you just talk to attendants. They usually know how it goes, and so very, very lucky that we've not had to ever check a violin underneath the plane.
Right. Did you know, I remember there, Joshua Bell was kind enough to be on our program. He was playing at the Granada, and it was in the days before COVID when we actually had a studio, and I'd come in, and Richard would be on one side of the board, and I'd be on the other side of the board, and our guests would be in the studio with us. Those were the good old days. And so Joshua Bell was there with his incredible violin. And Richard was just, oh, he couldn't believe that. Well, Richard's a sound guy anyway. And he could not believe that. Do you remember Richard?
I do indeed. And of course, one of the things that has always fascinated me is how some of these instruments even came to be. You know, who is the first person to decide, well, let's put this piece of wood together and this type of wood and then these strings. And I know that they used to use catgut. I can't remember if they did for, no, I'm thinking of tennis rackets. I apologize.
No,
But
they didn't.
did
Oh,
what?
Oh,
you're right.
okay. All right. Well, I wasn't far. But it's always fascinated me how these instruments, you know, came to be. I can understand, you know, playing a washboard or an old still a jug, you know, the jug band and that kind of thing. But to create, you know, those kinds of things has just always fascinated me.
Well, I don't, maybe the gentleman know. Jonathan, what can you say about that?
Right. Well, now technology is so advanced, you can do 3D scans of violins, and there's so many new pieces of technology and instruments you can use to make a violin. But back in the day, if you think about Joseph Guarnerius and Antonius Stradivarius, those guys were using simple rulers and pencils, and somehow they managed to create these instruments that were just proportionally perfect. If you take a Stradivarius and you look at the corner of a Stradivarius, you can actually measure it, and it follows all the perfect proportions, the golden mean, the Fibonacci sequence. They really had it down to a T with such simple instruments. So it's quite extraordinary.
Well, but what fascinates me is where the idea came from in the first place. That's what always has intrigued me.
Oh, I think just the human condition is to create and to move the soul. And to get to experiment with the shape of instruments and the crafting of them so that we could make sounds that ultimately we're all moved by. And I think that's probably where it comes from. And then you realize that then there's a demand for that kind of sound, and people learn to play it, and they learn to play it more and more kind of deeply over time. And I think that's the interesting thing. We have this trajectory, and this we have today in our instruments, this relic of the past that has been through this journey of time, and it's absorbed a little bit of what everybody's put into it over the hundreds of years.
You know,
Incredible.
Richard, what's also interesting to me is when the sound produced by someone playing a stringed instrument, when that sound in the learning curve of the instrument, when that sound it transmutes from horrible to listen to, like you've got your 8-year-old practicing violin, and until you have the kind of quality of these gentlemen, in their instruments, where it's as Jonathan Dorman was saying, it's soul touching. I don't know, when that changes, when it moves from that, cat screech to a beautiful sound.
Yes.
I'll quickly add that if we take the same instrument, if I play another cello, the same cello, and another cellist is playing it, because individually we bring a slightly different sort of weight and pressure to the instrument, and we have a different kind of touch, that instrument, because it's an organic material, the wood will absorb the characteristics of each player, and I think that's something that's really interesting too.
Ah, that's interesting. That's interesting. That's sort of like, I don't know what that's called. There's a word for that when you put your human touch, your humanity into something. Like, for example, in what I do, you know, I'm an appraiser, and I'm looking at people's households every day. And I remember being in the gentleman's household where he had passed away, but his eyeglasses that he'd worn for like 50 years were sitting on the bureau. And the minute I touched them, I could feel who he was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I know that there's a word for that. I want to just, go ahead.
Synergy between you and the instrument, I think.
It's a synergy, you said.
Yeah, between you and the instrument, you have that connection that we become one and more than just yourself, you know, together.
Fantastic, fantastic. You know, when we get back from the break, I would like to talk a little bit about the foursome, this quartet. As I said, they're four members from different parts of the world, and why that matters and why it matters to them, their ethos and their repertoire as well, is because from what I could gather in my research, they're all about breaking down cultural barriers. And that means they're very innovative with who is on stage with them at any given time. And that's a real difference with this quartet. And I want to talk a little bit about what I discovered about the cross-section between the four of them that are from different corners of the world, and then the breaking down of cultural barriers right there on stage. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the instruments and some of the performers that they've played with that'll really surprise you guys, my listeners. It'll really surprise you. Let's go to a quick break, Richard. When we get back, we'll talk a little bit about the cultural break, dissolution. Welcome back. The music you're hearing during the break is that of the Verona Quartet coming to see us and play for us Thursday, March 21st at 7:30 at Santa Barbara Museum of Art, Mary Craig Auditorium. And tickets extremely reasonable, $20 if you're a member, $25 if you're a non-member. They're going to perform Walton String Quartet, number 2 in A minor. Teksu Kim's, I don't know how to pronounce that, Ritus Sanitatum, and Dvorak's String Quartet number 14 in A flat major, opus 105. We'll think about that and you'll say, okay, I get the Dvorak. I understand that. Teksu Kim, I don't think I know Teksu. And let's go back to the theme of this segment, which is I wanted to talk with the two musicians about they're breaking down the cultural barriers, intersections of art forms, and collaborations with really interesting people and performers in their ethos. So first of all, talk to us a little bit about this Teksu Kim piece.
Well, so we actually have a relationship with Teksu that goes way back. Teksu and the String Quartet were classmates at Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music. That's where we met. And as a quartet, the first composer we ever worked with in school was Teksu Kim. He wrote us a piece back then. And so fast forward 10 years, you know, we reconnected with Teksu and he said, we'd love to work with you. Why don't you write us this piece? And so Ritus Sanitatum was born, and I'll have Jonathan Dorman talk a little bit about it.
So This piece really came from the inspiration behind Music and Healing, and the work title means a rite of healing. And we were particularly interested in Teksu's background from South Korea and what traditional medicine might look like. And so he went away and thought about it and came back with this idea. And the three different movements within it, they look at a different aspect of traditional Korean medicine, whether it's sort of chanting, shamanistic rituals, a little bit. The last movement includes some of the Italian tarantella, but also some kind of psychedelic rock. And also the second movement is a kind of acupuncture. So this very sharp injections to the skin, and the sound of that, and then the kind of release, and the idea that you might create a tiny bit of discomfort in order to actually have healing afterwards.
Okay, so it's mixing the senses completely, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's very...
Go ahead.
I just want to say is, you know, he's also based in Southern California in San Diego. And so it's kind of nice to have a Southern Californian vibe as well.
Is he coming for the performance?
I think he might, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this various collaborations. And right, I read that you collaborated with an Emirati poet from the UAE. And that must have been fascinating that you also performed with a virtuosi pipa player.
Right. Uman, what a wonderful musician and a Chinese lute. We just had a collaboration last year. Yeah, as you know, the name Verona and Verona Quartet comes from Shakespeare. You know, we believe that all music is storytelling and all art in by extension is storytelling. And so we chose the name Verona as a tribute to one of the greatest storytellers of all time, William Shakespeare. And you know, as artists, it's very easy for all the different arts to get segregated from one another. You get the musicians in one corner, you get the visual artists in another, and you have dancers in another corner. We don't get to work together, but we really believe that there is a cross-section or an intersection of the arts, so to speak, where we can tell a story together, because all our various art forms can come together and create perhaps an even more powerful, compelling performance. So we really endeavor to work with musicians of different disciplines and different cultures to see what might be possible. You know, and very often we are very surprised and inspired by the communication and the exchange that happens in a moment.
And dancers too.
Absolutely, dancers. We actually just did a piece at the Smithsonian by a Singaporean composer, Cheng Jin Ko, with Chinese ribbon dance and string quartet and hammer dulcimer. So, and you can actually find it online.
What a combination. I just want to shout out, this is the dancers on stage, visual artists have been on stage with them, performance artists, et cetera, and they also have given opera salons in the old-fashioned way. As a quartet, you know, they were a quartet in residence at IU. Little bit of background. When my son's father was studying for his MBA at IU, I worked in the library there for 3 years. So I'm very familiar with Bloomington. They taught at USC Thornton School of Music. They taught at Juilliard, Singapore Conservatory, New England Conservatory, Williams, UNC. And one thing that I was reading that I was really proud, Danville, Illinois, they had a special thing happen there. And Danville, they had a 2-year program of outreach performances and master classes from kindergarten to 12th grade. And they doubled the interest in music at many, many of the schools in Danville. They played in concert for hospitals, elderly homes, and they have a commitment to do more of that artist in residence program in one place where they can teach up to 40 schools. They can be active in many schools, bringing music to K through 12. And I have to say, if something like this, it didn't happen with artists like yourselves, there would be such a lack because schools today don't really do music. I know I would not have graduated high school if there wasn't for the music department. I really would have dropped out. And our music department was so strong that we still keep in touch. You know, we were all in a certain band, and we all of us still keep in touch 50 years later.
Sorry to interrupt. I think we can all agree that music, while it might be considered by many people handling the budget to be non-essential, I think we can all prove that it is essential because it teaches you so many important life skills. It teaches you how to concentrate better. It teaches you how to appreciate others, how to learn to listen to each other. And, you know, more importantly, it teaches compassion. And I think a world with all of those qualities in it is a much better world than one without it. So cutting back on those things is not, for our taste, ideal. And I think a little bit more understanding of that. And if we can just do a tiny little bit to bring some of that to people, then we're doing a little bit of the job, but we hope that everyone else agrees with that.
You know, it's amazing that, you know, looking at what you've done together, I don't know how you fit in the time to do the following, which was you received the Chamber Music America's coveted 2020 Cleveland Quartet Award. And Richard, they've played at Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, Kennedy Center, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, Wigmore Hall, and worldwide festivals. On top of that, they spread themselves to a small school system like Danville, Illinois, to actually teach and be members of the community there. I think it's fantastic.
Now, it tells me, Elizabeth, they don't get out much.
Yeah. Wow. Well, wow. And they're great ambassadors. We're going to be so excited to see them here in Santa Barbara Thursday, March 21st at 7:30 at Santa Barbara Museum of Arts, Mary Craig Auditorium. And it's kind of a homecoming for Jonathan Ong. And so we welcome him back. As I mentioned, he was concertmaster at the Music Academy of the West, our beautiful place in Montecito. So go ahead, Jonathan. What?
No, we're very excited to come, and we hope people come to the concert. It's going to be a wonderful time, and we look forward to meeting everyone after.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thank you guys very much. And Richard, I want to go to break, and I'm going to switch horses here because I'm going to be speaking to a number of performers who are opening at the Ojai Art Center Theater a twisted comedy called Dear. And one of Anna Catula is an actress with them for, she's been on the program a number of times, delightful actress. And she actually said, you know, this is going to be a really interesting play, and I think you should cover it. So I want to speak to a couple of performers. I've got Taylor Kosh on the line and Cynthia Killian on the line. And we're going to talk a little bit about David Henderson's play, The Deer, opening at Ojai. So don't turn that down. Back with another treat for you guys. Thank you, Jonathan Ong. And one of my favorite theaters in our neck of the woods, the Ojai Art Center Theater, always brings such interesting things. And it's such a cool theater with such a long history. And you know, you can't swing a cat in Ojai without hitting a great creative person. And the you know the talent that is in our little Ojai is amazing. The Ojai Art Center Theater is opening a play written by Aaron Mark, who is here with us today. And it's a new comedy called Dear, and it's the second show of the landmark 85th season. Like I said, Ojai Art Center Theater goes back a long time. This show is directed by David Henderson, who's here with us today. And it stars Cynthia Killian and Taylor Koch. It is the lives of the couple who are really a couple. I mean, we'll talk about that. And Cynthia and Ken, and they're dealing with an accident involving a deer. And it's critics have praised the play for engaging narrative, complex characterization. It was performed in Portland, for example, and the paper there described it as a twisted and transfixing tale, equal parts creepy and comical. And you know, it features a performing couple who are a couple in real life, stage veterans Cynthia Killian and Taylor Koch. And well, like I said, it is performed by a couple of a couple. And I really want to talk about that. Aaron Mark, who's here, is an award-winning playwright and director known for compelling storytelling and a repertoire of critically acclaimed plays. How do you pronounce that, Aaron? Empanada Loca,
Oh,
Squeamish?
empanada loca. Yes, empanada.
Empanada Loca, thank you. Squeamish,
That's a
Another
good one.
Medea, all published by Dramatists Play Service. He is a creator, writer, director of Amazon's The Horror of Dolores Roach and the podcast that inspired it. Fantastic playwright. And of course, this is, we should talk about it. It's opening March 29th. It plays through April 21st, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 at the Ojai Arts Center Theater. So I want to start off, Aaron, tell us about the play. What inspired you?
What inspired me, I wrote this play. I was living in New York. This is about 10, 11 or 12 years ago. And a dear friend of mine, Alison Fraser, who's an actress in New York, told me this story. She was driving from Manhattan, where she lived, to her house in the Poconos. And she and her friend hit a deer, as one does. And this deer was very, very injured. And it sparked this sort of existential conversation between the two of them. Who would have to put the deer out of its misery if it came to that? And a few days later, she was back in the city. She told me about this story. And I just thought, well, this is a fabulous, inciting incident for an examination of two people who think they know each other, right? And so that's the beginning of this play. And from there, we learn about this couple, Cynthia and Ken, who are Manhattanites, who are in their house in the Poconos, who, as I said, think they know each other.
So in the play itself, you say they think they know each other, but they are a married couple for a number of years in the play.
Well, I'm being figurative. They know each other very, 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 very well. What I mean is that this event illuminates for them that perhaps there are things they don't know about each other. This is my interpretation of the play, of course. I have to say I'm not involved in this production. I'm going to be so thrilled to go see it, but you know, David certainly might be a better person to speak to, you know, how he's interpreting this particular production.
I would love to have David talk to us about that. And I also want Cynthia and Taylor to talk about, I mean, if I can't imagine doing something like this with my partner. I can't imagine. I just can't imagine the kind of I almost want to say tension it would bring to the house, you know, to have this.
You know, that's a whole nother play, and it really, you know, there's guaranteed. But it's interesting. It kind of crosses over, you know, when you're working on certain parts of the play that, you know, you're trying to explore, and you sort of explore the real relationship at the same time, and not consciously, but it just kind of happens.
I was thinking that would probably happen, but on a level that I don't know. It would seem to me that it would open up some doors that you didn't really want to have opened up, or maybe you do. Well, Cynthia, what do you think?
Taylor and I were in Virginia Woolf years ago, And that was that was interesting. And in terms of doing this show, so many of our friends have said, oh, you must be having so much fun working on this together. But it is a very tense but funny play. So, yeah, it is a little bit different working with your partner on this because you are allowed to, I'd like to say, cross lines that you typically wouldn't cross with other actors. And I think part of that's a good thing. And part of it's maybe not such a good thing. I wouldn't call this whole process fun. I would call it very emotional and funny at times. It's been really interesting, though, working again together. Yeah.
Okay. So now that's an interesting parallel of being in Virginia Woolf together. And now this play is very interesting, that parallel, that tension. And I guess David Henderson, who's directing the show, are you, I almost want to say milking, but it's the wrong adjective. Are you using the dynamics of Cynthia and Taylor as a couple to explore the couple's names?
Ken and Cynthia?
Ken and Cynthia, that's right. Are you, I won't say milking, but you know what I'm driving at. Are you delving into that area?
Well, it definitely makes some of the conversation in a sense easier because the history is there. And so we can draw parallels to the history of these characters who are going through some really tough times. Have been through some tough times, but now, like as Aaron said, everything's brought to bear. One of the one thing that sort of helped me understand that a lot is the design of the set, and that there's sort of a facade to it, and then the rest of it are the guts. We see a lot of the inside. So much like Ken and Cynthia, who have this idea of what their marriage is, behind it is a whole lot of other stuff that's spilling out, and in the midst of that we get a lot of comedy of it because it is very true to relationships. It's not just Taylor and Cynthia's relationship that we can draw parallels, but any friendships, lovers, you know, those parallels are just as easily drawn.
When I was emailing with Anna, who is handling the press for this and a great actress herself at Ojai, I was thinking of an appraisal that I'm an appraiser. And I'm thinking of an appraisal I did, which I was reading about Aaron's play, The Deer. And then I was invited to appraise for a couple that was divorcing. They were in their 90s. They'd been together 60 some odd years, and they had recently lost a grown child who was 60 something. And that the death of that child, which of course at 60, that child to them, caused a fissure in their relationship that at the age of 90 something, they decided to part ways. And I was thinking either what did you say?
Oh, I was just saying, where do you go at 90 something when the marriage has ended? And
well, that's there's the practicality part of it, but it's just that this was something that kind of, you know, kind of event like that can either pull a couple together or pull them apart.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they didn't really think much about where they were going to go. They just wanted to go. Mm. You know, and they wanted me to provide a dollar figure of the whole household so that they could sell parts of the household to each other, you know, and I don't know where they're going to go. I don't think they know where they're going to go. But Aaron, you were shaking your head. Yes, you understand this.
Well, that rings very true when thinking about this play, a couple that's been together for a very long time. And what kind of incident, what kind of traumatic incident would shake a relationship into a different kind of focus? And, you know, whether or not this particular couple is going to stay together or not, I think we won't spoil. But that certainly rings true.
David, as the director.
Mm-hmm.
So are you bringing anything of your real life into this? In other words, your relationships, do you see any reflections there?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, part of the reason that theater works so well is because as specific as it can get, it's also universal. You know, we have a language that we can speak from the stage to audience members and creatives. Single person, I mostly attribute this to, you know, I think about past relationships or friendships that can have these sort of the friendships that can have their own traumatic events like this. So, yeah, I mean, I see some parallels, but not as many of the relationship parallels as maybe Cynthia and Taylor have.
And then there's, go ahead, Cynthia, please.
No, I was going to say the thing, Aaron, since I haven't had the opportunity to speak to you before, I stumbled across this play. I had caught my eye online and I ordered that and Squeamish, which is another play that Aaron wrote. Taylor and I have long been huge fans of dark comedy. It's our favorite genre. And Dear in particular, I can't tell you how many times I laughed out loud throughout this play. It is a very twisted sense of humor. But for whatever reason, sometimes we laugh at something that is incredibly dark.
Yeah.
Maybe if we ran across it in real life. That's what really struck me about this play was it was not only a relationship play, but it was a very darkly humorous play.
I love hearing that. Thank you for saying that. It's a comedy. It's a gruesome play, I would say, but it's a comedy. It's a very dark comedy.
Yes.
I can't wait to see it because something happened to me in when I was first married and my son's father was a Scot, so he was not familiar with America and he was not familiar with the Midwest at all, where I grew up. And we were visiting a family member in Michigan on the Upper Peninsula, and it was winter. And you know where I'm going with this. So I had a convertible Fiat Sport Spider with a soft top, canvas top. And Adrian was driving, and yes, he hit a 5-point buck. And the antler went right through the middle of both of our seats. And we were spared, but the buck was not. So I get it. And my question for David, the director, is how do you navigate? You said my new puppy is sounding out. You let the set help you, right? You mentioned?
Yes.
Tell me more.
Well, you know, when you're theater itself is a lot of metaphor. It's visual poetry and language poetry as well. But you know, when you're working on designing a set like that, it has to be A, practical, and B, express some of the vision of the play. And so in particular, this one, we went with a large A-frame, which is very popular on the East Coast and the Poconos and upper and New York State. And so we went with something that didn't have just a lot of walls and doors. In fact, when you sort of look at it, it's almost a sculpture that complements and helps tell with the storytelling of the play and the characters. Go ahead.
And what's it like, Aaron, to see because you've obviously seen this play, your play that you wrote, performed many times. Do you learn anything about yourself when you're watching a new production of your play?
Oh, my God. Yes. I mean, that's a great question, and terrifyingly so. I mean, as I said, I wrote this, I think, 11 or 12 years ago, and so I haven't seen it in years. And I'm so thrilled that it's happening. I can drive from, you know, where I live in L.A. I'm so thrilled. But it's a terrifying thing to go, oh, my God, that's what I had to get out of my system a decade ago. Holy mother, you know.
Right. So, Taylor, I want to just a quick shout out to Taylor. He's worked at the Minneapolis Cricket Theater, and my background is
a long time ago.
Yes. But I want to say this is 6 degrees of separation because I did set design for ACT in San Francisco and also at the Guthrie.
Oh, wow.
So I was a set decorator. Yeah. In my really young years, you know, as a young artist. And so it goes back to the when I read the cricket. I remember the cricket, San Francisco Actors Theater. He performed Los Angeles. At LATC, original founder of the Flying H Group Theater, which I've actually interviewed, that began in Ojai, resurrected in Ventura, continued to act and direct and teach acting workshops, et cetera. And as we said, wide performer, Death of a Salesman, American Buffalo, Zoo Story, Virginia Woolf. And not only is he a performer, but he's a director. And then his wife, Cynthia Killian, she's performed on stage, on boats, in railways, and she's done scripted and improv theater, and she's performed at Ojai Art Center Theater previously in Becky's New Car, and Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, and all of those I covered, and she's had lead roles in The Roommates, The Other Place, The Pillow Man, Virginia Woolf, also co-owner of the Flying H Group.
Yeah, that was all Flying H. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a couple. Have you ever, Aaron, known of a couple doing this as a couple?
I don't think it's ever been done by a real life couple. I'm so thrilled that it's happening. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk just a little bit for a few minutes about that and how you feel about that when we get back from the break. Richard's giving us some. We got to go to quick break. But I'd love to have us go out with that particular thought process in your mind, Aaron. Don't turn it down. Back in a minute.
Round, and we had 55, 60 seats, and so we were able to do. Oh, here we go.
Oh, okay. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. We're celebrating a play by Aaron Mark Deere, and it opens at the Ojai Art Center Theater from March 29th through April 21st. And we have the honor of having the playwright on the show today, Aaron Mark. And I'll ask Aaron to reflect for 2 seconds right before we have to say goodbye, if this play has ever been acted by a real life couple. And he said no. And he, tell me more, Aaron.
Not to my knowledge. The actors I originally worked on it with in New York years ago had been collaborators for many decades and knew each other very well, but certainly were not a couple. I don't know of a production that's been done by a real life couple.
And David, what do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, I love it. The only thing that's hard is that Cynthia's character is also named Cynthia. So half the time that Taylor starts talking to Cynthia, I have to sort of ask myself, is he in
Which
character
Cynthia?
Or he, but we've been able to figure it out and it's gone pretty well so far.
And I think somebody should interview us 3 months down the track. See if we're still a couple.
That's its own play.
No, that's it. You know, talking about crossing the lines. You know, is like she'll look at me and she goes, "You're supposed to be over there. You're supposed to be over there. You're supposed to," you know, you wouldn't really say that to another actor. You kind of wait for the director to do it, but Cynthia doesn't have a problem doing that.
That must bring a whole different level. You know, it's so unique in so many ways, this play. And I just want to say, you know, this is a unique opportunity to see a really unique play in a unique setting. And you'll probably, you know, watch out driving to Ojai from Santa Barbara, because you better watch out for those deers that jump out. They really do on
and
top of it all.
There. Especially if you're 150.
Yeah.
Before we go, I know we're coming up towards the end. I just wanted to say that on the 14th, is that right, Aaron? August 14th.
I think the 12th. I think it's the 12th.
Oh, sorry. August 12th, we'll be having a talk back with the playwright following the performance.
August or April?
April.
Oh. Did I say August?
Yeah.
April 12th.
There's no way I'm going to do this.
You're running all summer.
It's the long run.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Good luck. Break a leg.
You.